Session 3, Children Education Ministry, 3CEM, 1 Room 2, to topic understanding mental health in children. Michelle Hong. So, good afternoon again. So, our next topic is about understanding mental health in children. So our speaker is Michelle Hong. Let me introduce her first. Dr. Michelle Hong received her Doctor of Psychology degree in Clinical Psychology from Biola University. As part of her training, she completed an internship at the Fair Haven Hospital, where she provided therapy sessions in inpatient and outpatient setting, as well as psychological assessment to children and adolescents. Dr. Hong, utilizes an attachment-based framework for understanding and working with patients. She is trained in psychotherapy, as well as psychological and neuropsychological assessments. She is currently employed at Loma Linda University Health Children Hospital and does comprehensive ASTM assessments. So let's welcome Dr. Michelle Hong.
So, as Rebecca mentioned, I'm Dr. Hong. Thank you for having me today. So, my topic is on understanding mental health in children. And the main thing that I want to do today is really have you guys get a good idea of what mental health looks like, specifically for with children, and then maybe some things you could do to keep a watch out for or to help benefit their mental health. So for this presentation, I want you guys to think about one question that you would like to learn from this presentation today. So think about, you know, what's something new that you want to understand based on kind of what I'm going to be talking about. Okay. So in terms of what I'm going to go over today, I'm first going to talk about what are emotions. So I think in order for us to understand mental health, we have to have a good idea of what emotions are and why we have them. I'm going to give some biblical examples of emotions as well, talk about the purpose of emotions, talking about when emotions become maladaptive, so that means when they're no longer helpful to us, the diagnostic criteria for anxiety and depression. So as psychologists, when do we give a diagnosis of depression and when we give a diagnosis of anxiety? So I'll talk about those two things, and then something that you guys could do to help children. So to start with, emotion is defined as a conscious mental reaction usually accompanied by physiological and behavioral changes in the body. So what that means basically is it's an experience that we have that affects how our body reacts to things and how we behave in response to those things. So some other words that people might use instead of emotions would be mood. You could use the word feelings or the word affect. So these are all things that are used to describe emotion. Okay. So generally speaking, in research, there's about 6 primary emotions. So that means all other emotions are based off of some combination of these 6. And I think there's a lot of debate in research about whether or not there are 6 of them, if there are 8 of them, if there are 4 of them. So there isn't really anything consistent in the research currently, but generally these are the emotions that people tend to think about. So there's sadness, there's joy or happiness, there's fear, disgust, and anger. And the 4 that I think all researchers typically talk about in terms of core emotions are happiness, sadness, fear, and anger. So those are going to be the 4 that I'm going to be focusing on today, but there is a pretty wide range of emotions that people feel. So this is a chart that looks at the different emotions. So you can see at the top and at the side, we have sort of the core emotions that we feel. And then in the middle of the chart has a lot of kind of more specific emotions. And so you can see that all of the other emotions are sort of a mix of the different primary emotions that we feel. So for example, the feeling of betrayal is a mixture of anger and sadness together. Okay, so that's kind of how we understand emotions. There's a lot of different combinations of them. Now, I don't think this chart is 100% accurate, but I think it gives us a good idea of how our emotions sort of mix together to create new ones. So this is a feelings wheel. I really like this because it gives a lot of examples of different kinds of emotions that we feel. And it's really good to use with children because it's colorful and it has lots of examples that they can really draw from and understand. So in the center there, we have our core different emotions. So you'll see joy, sadness, anger, and fear in there. And then as we branch out, it has different feeling words that can be used to describe sort of the subcategories of those emotions. So within sadness, you can also feel shameful, you can also feel guilty, you can feel hurt. Within the feeling of joy, you can feel optimistic, you can feel hopeful. So there's a lot of words used to describe emotions, and I think it's really important for us to be able to have those words to help children be able to express themselves. So this is really good to use. So the emotions that we feel are affect the things that go on around us and are also affected by the things around us. So these include our environment, our thoughts, our behaviors, and our physical symptoms. So what happens is we generally have a situation that happens, right, or a trigger, and then as the situation is happening, there are typically four things that are going on. There's the feelings here, and so that's what emotion we're experiencing. We have the physical symptoms, which is what's going on in your actual body. We have thoughts, which is what's going on in your head, and then we have behaviors, which is what you're doing. So for example, if the situation is I'm standing up here, right, my feeling is that I'm really nervous because I had to talk in front of a lot of people, right? So I'm feeling nervous. So some of the symptoms I might be having is my heart rate is increased, right? My hands are getting kind of sweaty, I'm getting a little fidgety, I might be talking faster because I'm getting more nervous, right? And so some of the thoughts I might be having are they understanding what I'm saying? You know, are people bored? Is anyone listening? So these are all things that are all happening at the same time. And then some of the behaviors, again, might be kind of that fidgeting, sort of moving around a lot. So these are all things that influence one another. Okay. And as you can see, there are arrows pointing to all the different parts, which means none of these things happen by themselves. So when we have feelings, we also have thoughts that go together with them. When we have physical symptoms, we also have behaviors that go together with them. So we never experience just one of them by themselves. Okay. And the arrows are pointing in all the different directions, which means we don't only experience them in one order. They can happen in all sorts of different orders. So another example could be if I wanted to help maybe myself feel less nervous, right, I might take a deep breath. Right, and that would be the behavior. And so that might calm my body down. It might slow my heart rate down, which would affect my physical symptoms. Right? So that might cause my thoughts to be a little bit slower. I can probably think a little bit more clearly. So that would influence my thoughts. And then that would make me feel less nervous. Okay? So I think this chart, what it does is it sort of lays out the different ways that we experience emotion and how it interacts with all the different other aspects of our functioning. Okay, so purpose of emotions. Why do we have emotions? I think this part is really important. The first thing is that it helps us organize our rational thinking. So when we have memories, a lot of times the memories that stand out the most to us are the ones that have the most emotional impact. So the ones where we feel really sad or really excited or really angry, those are the memories we tend to remember the most. And when we remember those things, that can help us know what to do in the future. So for example, if I eat something and it tastes really gross and it's disgusting and I get really sick from it, right, my emotional experience is that I felt disgust. Right? I might feel a little bit of fear that something wrong is with my body. So then in the future, if I come across the same food, I know not to eat it again. Right? So that emotional experience of disgust helps me to think through my decisions for the future. Okay? So that's one thing that it does. The other thing is that it guides our perceptions of the world, influences our memories, and affects our moral judgment. So again, what emotions do is it affects how we sort of remember things and how we experience things. So if at the end of the talk today, if I'm in a really good mood and someone says, hey, I think you did a really good job, then this to me would become a happy memory. Right? I'd be like, oh, I did a really good job, they enjoyed it. So that's going to influence how I remember this specific event. But let's say I make a mistake or I embarrass myself somehow, so maybe my mood isn't so good at the end of the talk. If someone says, hey, I think you did a really good job, I might think, oh, well, they're just trying to be nice. Oh, well, they're just pitying me. And then that's going to change how I remember this specific event. So our own emotional state and our experiences influence how we remember things and how we experience things. Emotions also help us to organize our social lives. So the way that we function is in a society, which means we interact with a lot of different people. And what our emotions do is it helps us to keep a sense of balance in society. So there are a lot of rules, both rules that are kind of the law and then also some unspoken rules that we have. And in order for us to maintain that, we use sort of our emotional functioning. So there's a fear of breaking the law, right? We maintain balance because we are scared that we're going to get punished. There's a lot of shame involved if you are very different or if you act differently from what's expected of you. There can be a lot of guilt as well. So all of those emotions work together to help us maintain balance in society. Okay, so that's another thing that emotion does for us. It motivates action and are also goals that we seek to achieve. So when we feel good and when we feel happy, we want to do things. We want to be more productive. We want to get things done. At the same time, we also do things because we want to feel happy. So our end goal is to feel good, and that motivates us to want to do more things. So emotions both drive us to be productive and are also the end goal of why we do things. And most of what we do is intended to create pleasant feelings or avoid uncomfortable emotions. So if you think about your interactions with other people, it's a lot of, you know, I want to spend time with people that make me feel good, and I also want to avoid people that don't make me feel good. Right? So a lot of what we do socially and just even in our work or the interactions that we have, it's largely based on how comfortable are we in this situation and how do we make ourselves more comfortable or how do we get away from something that makes us uncomfortable. So again, that sort of emotion kind of drives a lot of our behaviors. Okay. So at this point, what I'm going to go through and talk about each of the specific emotions, mainly the four core emotions, and talk more about why we have them and why they're important. Okay. So for happiness and joy, the purpose of joy is that it's a pleasurable feeling, right? It's something that makes us feel good, right? We like to feel happy. We like to feel joy. It also creates the urge to be playful. So as adults, I know it sounds kind of like a weird thing, like adults being playful, but when we're happy, that's usually when we want to reach out and connect to other people. When we feel good, we want to spend time with others. We want to get to know people. It also, depending on your work, for people who are in more like the arts, kind of that feeling of happiness also lends more creativity. You're more productive. You're able to come up with more things. So that's where happiness helps. And then for children specifically, play is their main way of learning. So children learn things through play. And I think that's really important because when they play is when they feel happy, right? Or when they're happy, they play. So if you think about like a soccer game, right? It's a form of play for children. There's lots of things that children learn through soccer. So they have to learn things like cooperation, right? How do you work with your teammates to get to the goal? They have to work on communication, right? How do you communicate with your teammates, both with your words, but also with your body, like eye contact, gestures, facial expressions, right? How do you coordinate with your teammates in order to come to that goal? You have to learn problem solving. So like if someone is in front of you, blocking you from the goal, how do you get around them, right? You also have to learn frustration tolerance. So if you lose, right, or someone steals the ball from you, that's really frustrating. What do you do? Right. So these are things that children will naturally develop and learn as they play and interact with different things. So that's where happiness comes in. It helps, again, to helps children interact with the environment in a way that helps them to learn. Okay. So for sadness, what sadness does is it helps us get our needs met. So I think that we were created in God's image, right? And God functions as a trinity. So there's God the Father, there's Jesus the Son, and then there's the Holy Spirit. So even Jesus himself is relational, right, within the three different bodies. And so as we were created in his likeness, I think that we were also created to be relational. We were designed to be with other people and to connect with others. So I don't think that we could function just by ourselves sort of in society. Now, I think we could probably survive, right? I think there are people out there who are amazing and can grow their own food and completely function on their own. But in terms of, like, good quality of life and really living a good life, I think we need to be with people. And so what sadness does is when we are sad, it lets people know that we have a need that hasn't been met. Because I think, again, because we were designed to be with other people, we have needs that only other people are able to meet because we can't do all of that by ourselves. And so what sadness does is it lets people know, hey, I have this need that isn't met, and it invites people to come to you. It also helps with seeking comfort. So when you're upset or when you're sad, people will come and they will comfort you. But if they don't know that you're sad, right, if you just look like you're happy all the time, no one's going to reach out and try to help. So that's what sadness does. If you guys have watched the movie Inside Out, that's a really big example of that. Okay. The third one is anger. So the purpose of anger is that it helps to ensure justice, and it protects us against exploitation. So it prevents people from taking advantage of us. So if something happens, for let's say I go to the store and I buy something, and it costs $15, and I give them $20, right? And so the guy gives me $1 in change. Well, he owes me $4 more, right? So if I don't say anything, if I don't get angry about that, I'm just going to leave, and I just lost my $4, right? And that's not fair, right? That's an injustice. And so what the anger does is it triggers me to say, hey, something's wrong here, right? Something's not right. And so then that will compel me to speak up to say, excuse me, actually you owe me $4 more, right? You owe me $5 and change. And so that protects me from getting taken advantage of by other people. Okay. The other thing that anger does is it protects our relationships. And I think this one is a little tricky to understand because most of the time people think of anger as something that destroys relationships. When you're angry, you fight, right, and that destroys the relationship. I think in this particular instance, the anger itself isn't the thing that hurts the relationship. It's what you do with the anger that harms it. So the anger in and of itself isn't a bad thing. How it protects relationships, again, is if there is someone taking advantage of you or someone that's doing something that annoys you, right, that anger, that feeling of anger is going to trigger you or sort of signal you that you need to speak up and say something. And so if you act on that appropriately and you speak up and say something, right, you can help solve the problem, right? You can resolve the conflict appropriately. And what that does is that maintains your friendship, right, or maintains your relationship. But if you never say anything and you just hold it in and hold it in and hold it in, what happens is you end up building resentment over time. You never resolve the issue, and then that can actually damage your relationships long term. So that's where, in this particular case, anger helps to protect your relationships. Okay. And then the last one is fear. What fear does is it protects us from harm. So again, if there are things that are dangerous, things that are scary or harmful, we tend to avoid those things, and that keeps us safe. It also maintains balance and cooperation. So as I mentioned earlier, kind of with rules in society, you know, we have a fear of breaking the rules. We have a fear of being punished. We have a fear of being vastly different from people. So that fear helps us to follow the laws and follow the rules of what everybody else is doing. So these are some of the purposes of emotions. Okay. So in the Bible, I think the Bible has a really good example of what emotions are. Both Jesus and God and a lot of the figures in the Bible express different emotions. So the first one is from John 11:35. It says, Jesus wept. That implies that he felt sadness. He was grieved. Mark 3:1-5, this is where the Pharisees were trying to trick Jesus into working on the Sabbath. And so there was a man who needed healing, and they were trying to see if they could get Jesus to heal him and therefore break the Sabbath. And so in verse 5, Jesus looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. So again, Jesus is expressing anger, and he's expressing grief. And then the last one, Ephesians 4:25-26, This one says, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. So again, even in this verse, it's not saying don't be angry or you can't be angry. It's saying be angry, but don't sin. So the anger itself isn't the issue here. It's the sinful aspect of it. Okay. And then there are a lot more that I didn't put in here. So like God feeling jealous for us, God feeling wrath, all of those things are in the Bible as well. But these were kind of the main ones that I wanted to put up here. Okay. So when we think about emotions, I think it's important to think about how we label them, because how you label them is going to affect sort of how you think about them and how you use them. So most of the time, we think about emotions as being positive or negative. Right? So positive emotions would be things like joy or love or contentment, excitement. Those are typically positive emotions. When we think about typically negative emotions, we have things like sadness, anger, jealousy. I think the problem with labeling emotions as positive or negative is that it sort of fixes them into either good or bad. Okay, so if an emotion is positive, like love, it's always a good thing. If sadness is a negative emotion, it's always seen as a bad thing. But as I've talked about earlier, all emotions have a specific purpose. So if they have a purpose, I don't think that there's feeling them isn't a bad thing if they have a reason. Okay. So again, we assume all positive emotions are good, all negative emotions are bad. I said all emotions have a purpose. And I think because God gave us the capacity or the ability to feel a wide range of emotions, we were meant to feel them, right? We're meant to use them. The Bible even shows us that Jesus uses emotions. And I think something God-given can't be bad. So I think the experience of emotions isn't a bad thing. Okay. So if there's anything that you're going to take away from my PowerPoint, it's going to be this. Mm-hmm. Experiencing and expressing emotions are not inherently bad. Okay, so as I've mentioned multiple times, the feelings that you have, those emotions aren't bad, and expressing them isn't bad. Right? So just like in Ephesians, when he says, be angry and do not sin, he's not saying don't be angry. So I think it's important for us to know that children have emotions and that we, even as adults, have emotions. It's okay to have those emotions. It's okay to express those emotions. It's a matter of how you express them and what you do with them that becomes really important. Okay, so an example of this is fire. So when we think about fire, right, the emotion that usually comes with that is anger, right? When you're angry, you get really fired up. But the thing about fire is there's lots of different kinds of fire, right? Most of the time, we think of it as something harmful. So it's something dangerous. You want to stay away from it. It burns things. Just like anger, we typically think of it as something bad, right? It's harmful. It destroys things. But again, there are lots of different kinds of fires, and there's also lots of different kinds of anger as well. So if you look at the top left, that is a picture of arson, which is when someone lights something fire on purpose in order to destroy it or to harm it. And so just like anger, we have a lot of really hateful anger that is used to destroy. So things like racism or hate crimes, that would be a very deliberate, harmful type of anger. Okay. The upper right picture is a forest fire. So that is a fire that occurs naturally, that happens, but it also destroys a lot of things. It can also be harmful even though it's natural. And so sometimes we see this with a lot of cases of children who have trauma, who have been abused or who have been hurt. They have a lot of anger. And I think that their anger is justified, right? Somebody hurt them, and so they're angry as a result of that. So I think in that case, they should be angry, right? Because it's not okay for people to be hurting you. And remember, anger helps to protect us. And so them feeling angry is a reaction to protect them. So it's a natural thing that occurs. But there are some people who use that anger to destroy other things. So if you think about some of the shootings that go on at the schools that have been happening recently, a lot of that, they come out and say, you know, the person had a lot of mental health issues, they were abused as a child. So they took that anger that they had and used it for something bad. So that could be an example of like a forest fire. The bottom left one, those are lanterns, and lanterns are used to bring light and to bring guidance to others. So similarly, we can also use our anger as a way to shed light on things or to bring education. So an example of this would be like Asians in media or in movies. A lot of times Asians are used in a very specific role and they're kind of very stereotyped. And so a lot of people were really upset about that and the way that Asians were portrayed. And so what happened was they came out with this movie, Crazy Rich Asians, to show how Asians can fulfill a lot of different roles and how we're not just, you know, the IT or we're just the sidekick or, you know, whatever those roles are. So that anger that they had about being stereotyped led to education for the general public to say, look, there's so much more that we can do. And then the last one is a campfire. So a campfire is warm and it brings people together, right? It's something that gathers people. And so similarly with anger, there are some forms of righteous anger. I think the Bible has lots of examples of righteous anger. But when we think about different movements that have happened as a result of people being upset with the way things were, so like for women's rights, they had marches for that. Freedom of slaves, they had marches for that. So that was a type of anger where it brought people together in a way that sort of created a positive change. Okay. So again, similar to how we have lots of different kinds of fires, there's lots of different types of angers, and they all can do different things with it. Okay. So again, we want to move away from the idea that emotions are positive or negative or that we have good and bad emotions, because you can see for anger, which is something usually thought of as bad, there's both good and bad things that can be done with it. Okay. All right, so in terms of labeling emotions, instead of saying positive emotions or good emotions, we can sort of reframe and think of them as pleasant emotions, right? These are emotions that feel good. Instead of saying negative emotions, we can say they're unpleasant or uncomfortable, or we could say they're difficult, right? Because it's hard to deal with sometimes. So that could be another way of thinking about them. And then in terms of relabeling emotions, another way that we want to think about it is adaptive versus maladaptive. So what adaptive means is it's something that benefits or helps us. Emotions that are healthy and move us toward positive growth. And then maladaptive emotions are ones that are not healthy for us or ones that are harmful. So either we have too much of an emotion or we direct it in a way that's not good, and it either harms ourselves or it harms other people. So like Cain in the Bible was angry. Right, and so for him that was a maladaptive emotion because it led him to murder his brother. Right, Jesus was also angry, but it was adaptive because it led to healing. So we want to think about adaptive versus maladaptive. Is this emotion helpful for me or is it unhelpful? Okay. In terms of our emotional experiences, we experience emotions on a spectrum. So that means we can feel a little bit of an emotion and we can also feel a lot of emotion, or we can feel it somewhere in between. So we don't just feel feelings kind of in a set way. We can experience different emotions at the same time. So you can be happy and you can be sad at the same time, which I know sounds a little bit weird, but I think as humans we're kind of amazing in that we can do both of those things. So if like a really good friend of yours gets a new job in, let's say, San Francisco, right? Pays six figures, incredible opportunity, your best friend is moving away. You can feel really happy for her or him that they have this amazing opportunity, but also really sad that your friend is leaving. Okay, so those two things can happen at the same time. We can experience different levels of different emotions at the same time. So similarly, you can be really, really happy and a little bit sad. You can also be really, really sad and a little bit happy. So just because you're feeling different emotions together doesn't mean you have to feel them all at the exact same level or same intensity. So it can vary. And then again, feeling emotions is normal. Okay. All right. So this comes to the main point, is when does feeling emotions become not normal? So I know I spend a lot of time talking about emotions and like what they do and all of that. And the purpose of my PowerPoint was to talk about mental health in children. And when we think about mental health, from a psychologist's perspective, it's usually when something goes wrong. And I think in order for us to know what like not normal looks like, we have to know what normal looks like, which is why I spent so much time talking about all the emotional pieces of it. Okay, so now that we have a better understanding, it's, I think, easier to understand what does it look like when it's not normal. So feeling too much or too little of certain emotions can lead to problems. So it's important for us to have an equal balance of what we feel. So again, just a brief recap, these are the purpose of what the emotions do for us. Okay. So I'm going to go through and talk about each one more specifically. So with happiness and with joy, again, the purpose of it is that it makes us feel good, right? It makes us feel motivated, so we want to get things done, we want to be productive when we're happy. When we have too much happiness, that can lead to mania. So mania is when you have really, really high mood. These are people who have way too much energy. It can also lead to a lot of risky behaviors. So sometimes when people are manic, they can do a lot of drugs. They can engage in a lot of really, I guess, dangerous sort of behavior, like driving really fast on the freeway, like going over 100 miles per hour, having sex with lots of different partners, not using protection, things like that. The other thing about mania is when you only focus on sort of the positive, you're not really thinking about the negative consequences of your actions, because you're only thinking about, this feels good and I like it. So it is possible to have, I guess, what looks like too much happiness in that sense, okay? Because we want to be aware of what are the negative consequences of our actions. The other thing about having too much happiness is that it can come off as disingenuous, which means it can be kind of fake. So I don't know if you've ever met anyone who's happy 100% of the time, all the time. Right? I don't know that I've ever met somebody like that. Because I think as people, again, we experience a whole range of emotions. We feel sad, we feel angry, we feel happy. So it's not normal if you meet someone who's always happy all the time, like nothing's ever wrong. And that can feel very fake, right? Because it's not a human experience that we have. When we don't have enough happiness or we don't have enough joy, that can lead to very negative thinking. So this is kind of like, you know, the worst case scenario, like the world is going to end type of thinking. As I mentioned earlier, our emotions affect how we interpret events in the world. So if you're not very happy, everything you're going to interpret is going to be negative. Well, they said this about me, so that means they don't like me. Oh, well, they, you know, like all of that kind of thing. And then also feelings of depression. If you don't have enough happiness, you're going to feel depressed, which is when you have too much sadness. For sadness, again, what it does is it invites comfort. Sadness also helps us to appropriately grieve things. So when something sad happens, someone passes away, someone moves away, we lose something important to us, we feel sad. That's a natural process. And so what that sadness does is it helps us to understand it. And so the way that our minds are designed is that we need to process events that happen. And when we don't process it, what happens is it starts to come back again and again and again until we deal with it. And so what sadness does is it helps us deal with it so that it doesn't affect us later on. Okay. So when we have too much sadness, again, there's the depression, right? So really low mood, not feeling good, very negative. You get some hopelessness, so that's like, there's really like no hope for the future and nothing's going to get better, that type of thinking. And then you can also have suicidal ideation, which is the thought of either not wanting to be alive or wanting to kill yourself. And that's a really big problem. So that's what happens when we have too much sadness. When we don't have enough sadness, we get emotionally stunted. So again, the idea of, you know, our minds need to process things. And if we don't allow ourselves to feel that sadness or to deal with it, we don't process it. And then we get stuck. And it's harder to move forward from that. The next one is anger. So again, anger maintains justice and helps us to maintain our relationships. When we have too much anger, it can cause physical stress in our bodies. So there's actually been a lot of research done about how stress can impact our medical health. So it can lead to hypertension, increased risk of heart attack, stroke, lots of other things. So when you're angry all the time, it actually puts a lot of physical stress on your body. The other thing it does is it damages your relationships. So imagine being around someone who's constantly angry, right? They're always yelling, they're always cussing, they're always getting mad at everybody. That's not really a good person to be around, right? You don't really want to be around that kind of person. So it also can hurt your relationships when you have too much anger. On the other side, and I know we talked about this earlier, if you don't have enough anger, you can get taken advantage of. Right? So people will exploit you. You'll become more of a pushover. It can also damage relationships in a different way, because if you don't get angry and you allow people to take advantage of you, what that does is it creates an imbalance in your relationship. So depending on, you know, what the relationship is, if it's a friendship or a romantic relationship, it's supposed to be equal, and what happens is one person now has more power over the other, okay? And it creates an imbalance, which then damages the relationship. And then the last one is fear. So again, fear helps to keep us safe. It also motivates us towards success, so things like fear of failing out of school, fear of losing your job, it's going to make you work hard to make sure that you are continuing to succeed. When we have too much fear, we can isolate from other people, so it means we don't want to be with other people, we tend to avoid other people, or avoid everything, depending on what you're scared of. You miss out on a lot of experiences when you have a lot of fear. And then it can also create a lot of anxiety. And I'll talk more about anxiety later. But again, it's that constant worrying that you have. And then when you don't have enough fear, there's more potential for harm. So you're not going to be aware of dangerous situations. You're going to more likely put yourself in a situation where you can get hurt by others or by things. And so we need a healthy sense of fear in order to keep ourselves safe. Okay. So in terms of the mental health piece, I'm going to talk more specifically about depression and anxiety. For mental health in children, there are lots of different types of disorders. So there are mood disorders. There's also ADHD, which is an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There's also an autism spectrum disorder, which is looking at social functioning and behavioral challenges. There's intellectual disability, which is looking at your cognitive skills. There's eating disorders. There's lots of different things for children. And that could be a whole other lecture in and of itself. So I'm just going to focus on the mood disorders, more specifically depression and anxiety, because those are the two that we tend to see the most. Okay. So with depression, what we're looking at is persistent and pervasive sadness or irritability. So in adults, we tend to see that as low mood. So someone, you're not really excited about things, you just kind of seem sad all the time. For children, we can see that, but we also see irritability, which means they are very easy to get angry. They might be more on edge. You might feel like you have to be careful around them all the time. So we'll see more of that. Persistent and pervasive, what that means is you see it most of the time. So for the majority of the day, someone seems sad. For maybe 5 out of the 7 days of the week, someone seems sad. So one of the important things to note about depression is that it doesn't mean that the person is sad 24/7. So just because they're laughing with their friends doesn't mean that they're not depressed. Right? Just because you see someone smiling or doing an activity or playing doesn't mean that they're not depressed. What we're really looking for is the majority of the time, what is their mood like? Okay. The other thing is we want to look for is loss of enjoyment of everyday activities. So things like hobbies, you know, are children engaging in the hobbies that they typically like? Are they playing with the toys they usually play with? Are they still playing with their other friends, or are they kind of playing by themselves more often? And we also want to look for any kind of negative thinking. So again, that's like assuming the worst about things, interpreting everything as something bad, any sort of hopelessness or suicidal thoughts. We want to look for any excessive ideas of guilt, remorse, or worthlessness. So that's things like feeling really bad about themselves, feeling really guilty for something that they had no control over, or feeling guilty about something that maybe happened like a month ago or 2 months ago, so much longer than this should be. The other one is slowing down, low energy, fatigue, or low activity. So if you have a child who usually runs around a lot and suddenly they seem to be moving a lot slower, they're kind of sitting all the time, not really moving, or when they do move, they move very slowly. That's something to also keep a lookout for. I think it's important that we want to remember that this is compared to how the child usually is. So there are some children who are naturally slower than others. There are some children who don't like to move around a lot, and that's okay. So we want to think about how are they usually, and is their activity level less than that? Okay. The other one is sleep disturbance. So if they're sleeping more than usual or sleeping less than usual, and again, we want to think about the child's age and how much sleep they're supposed to be getting. So younger children will naturally need more sleep, older children will not. But if you have an adolescent who's sleeping, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, that's a lot more than they should be sleeping. So something to look out for. The other one is appetite change or change in weight. So if they're eating a lot more than they should be or usually do, if they're eating a lot less than they usually do, if they're gaining a lot of weight or losing a lot of weight, that's something we want to look at. Somatic symptoms, so this has to do, again, with your body. So things like having stomach ache, headache, body ache, muscles hurting, things like that. And the thing about this piece is there's no medical explanation for it. So it's not like they ate something bad and their stomach hurts, or they're staring at the TV too long so they have a headache. This is one where there's no reason for it, but they have, you know, they feel sick to their stomach, or they, like their body hurts all the time. And then the last one is difficulty concentrating or focusing. So a lot of times this will come up in the school setting or any time where they need to sit and focus for a long time. If it seems like they're having a hard time focusing, get really distracted or kind of seem lost in their own world a lot compared to usual, that might be something to look at there as well. And specifically in children, depression does look a little bit different than what you would see in adolescents and what you would see in adults. A lot of times because children don't have the words to be able to express themselves, they can't do it in words. And so what they do it in, again, is their body. So a lot of times this will come out in acting out behaviors. So you see children become really aggressive. You see children become non-compliant, which means they stop following directions or they do the opposite of what you ask them to do on purpose. We see a lot of running away, so they try to run out of the classroom, they run away from home, and a lot of times they do these things because they don't know how to say what they're feeling, and so they do it with their body instead. So for depression, when we think about it from a clinical perspective, so this is like an actual diagnosis of it, not just regular sadness, we do need to see it every single day, most of the day, for at least 2 weeks. And that's what we call a major depressive episode. So if they're just sad for 1 or 2 days, that's not really concerning. That's not a big deal. But if we see it for, again, 2 full weeks, that's when we start to have more concerns. And again, it does have to be most of the day. The important thing, too, is that we have to see it affect their day-to-day activities. So if they aren't being able to finish their schoolwork or finish their homework, that's a problem. If they used to go, you know, play with friends or do sports and now they're just home all the time by themselves, that's a problem. Another one is self-care skills. So things like they won't brush their teeth, they won't shower, they won't change their clothes. Those are all things that we're really looking for. The other thing that's important to consider is developmental and environmental factors. So we want to think about what's normal for their age group and then also what's happening in the environment around them. So teenagers, especially as they're getting older, their brains are still developing, and their frontal lobe, which is what is responsible for our decision-making, our ability to plan and organize and do all of those things, it's still in the process of being developed. So children, a lot of times, or adolescents, usually are pretty bad at organizing and bad at planning. They're very impulsive, so they do things without thinking, because, again, they're still learning those skills. So that's something to think about. They're also more emotional in general. Teenagers tend to be more upset about things, a little bit more teary. So we do want to think about what's sort of typical for a teenager versus what's sort of excessive from that. And then in terms of environment, so what's happening around us, if something sad happens, like a death in the family or, you know, someone moves away, it's normal for someone to be sad. So in that case, we don't call that depression. So also something to be aware of. Okay. So the other one is anxiety. So anxiety can come out in usually 3 different ways. The first one is emotional, which is what's going on in your brain or your heart, depending on how you want to think about that. There's the physical symptoms, which is what's happening in your actual body. And then there's behavioral, which is what you're actually doing. Okay. So with the emotional symptoms of anxiety, we see excessive and irrational fear or worry. So this is someone who's worrying all the time, something's going to go wrong, something bad's going to happen, what if this happens? They have a lot of these types of thoughts. Now, I think, again, it's natural for us to feel worried about different things, so I really want to emphasize the excessive and the irrational part of it. So excessive is they're always worrying all the time, even when there's nothing to worry about. The irrational part is they're scared about things that they really don't need to be scared about. So I had a child one time tell me that he watched a video, I think, of the planet, and he was worried that the planets were going to crash into each other and we're all going to die. That's an irrational fear, right? That's probably not going to happen. Okay. Feelings of apprehension or dread, so that's, again, the worry that something bad is going to happen to you or someone that you love. Watching for signs of danger, so kind of looking around them a lot, to being very focused on their surroundings and what's going on around them, even when there's nothing to be worried about. Anticipating the worst, so again, expecting that the worst-case scenario is going to happen. Trouble concentrating or having racing thoughts. And a lot of this could be if they are worrying a lot about different things, if they are very aware of their environment and what's going on around them, it is going to make it really hard to focus and to concentrate, especially if your thoughts are just kind of going everywhere. So we do see a lot of that happen. Feeling tense and jumpy. And then irritability. So again, that's the kind of getting angry really easily. So those are all symptoms that we see that come with anxiety. The physical symptoms could be pounding heart, sweating or shaking, getting headaches is another one, or stomach aches, dizziness, having a hard time breathing, upset stomach, so having to use the restroom a lot, muscle tension, so if your body is really tensed up, or sometimes your muscle twitches. Insomnia, which is when you have a hard time falling asleep, and then feeling tired really easily or feeling sleepy during the daytime. And then for the behavioral symptoms, usually in children and adolescents with anxiety, we see a lot of rigidity, which means when they expect something to happen, it has to exactly happen that way. And they have a hard time being able to move away from that or have something different happen. We see a lot of rituals as well, so things have to happen in a certain order or a certain way, or else they have a hard time with it. We see a lot of perfectionistic behaviors as well, so again, everything has to be exactly the way that I want it to be. And the reason that we see a lot of that is because with anxiety and with fear, the biggest thing is I don't have control over my environment, right? Everything else is happening around me, and I can't do anything about it. So a lot of times that comes out in the rigidity of when I have control over something, I'm going to make sure that I 100% have control over this one thing because I can't control anything else. So that's why we see a lot of these behaviors come up. We do see isolating at times too. So again, kind of being wanting to be by themselves a lot. We see avoiding behaviors. So if there's something scary or fearful, they tend to avoid it or stay away from it. And then we see a lot of fidgeting as well. So that's like moving their hands a lot, kind of wiggling in their seat, things like that. Okay. And again, for a clinical diagnosis of anxiety, we do have to see it occurring more days than not. It has to affect their day-to-day life. And then similarly, we have to think about where they are in their development and is this normal for their age or not. And then again, if something scary happens, like they get into a car accident, it's normal for them to be a little bit more anxious. We would expect that. Okay. And both with the depression and the anxiety, you don't have to have all of these symptoms to meet criteria for the diagnosis. So you can have any different combination of these symptoms. But these are mostly the things that we're looking for. Okay. So in terms of caregivers, what can you guys do to help a child? The first one is to validate their feelings. So what that means is you letting the child know that you hear what they're saying and that you understand what they're feeling. The second one is focusing on listening and not lecturing. So if a child is having an issue or they're struggling, rather than trying to jump in and fix the problem or say, here, let me tell you what to do, really listening to what they have to say, right? Listening to why they're upset, why they're not happy. Confidentiality is a big one. So what this means is basically trusting and keeping what they tell you a secret. So if a child or an adolescent comes up to you and tells you that like something hard is happening, they're getting bullied at school, they're feeling really depressed, you don't want to go around and share that information with everybody you know. Okay? That's something that I think if other people don't need to know, it's something you can keep to yourself. Because that way the child then knows that they can trust you, and if they trust you, they're more likely to come back to you again. Okay. I think the only time that we don't want to do this is if there's a safety concern, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But for the most part, I think we want to respect the fact that they shared their feelings with us. And then the last one is be open to help. So knowing sort of your own limits and how much you can do for a child, and when you may need to refer out to a professional for help. Okay. So in terms of validating feelings, I'm going to talk a little bit more about each one in detail. So the biggest thing is don't try to talk your child out of their feelings. So if they say that they're feeling sad or they say that they're feeling upset, don't try to tell them that they're not sad or that they're not upset, because that's not helpful for them. Okay. You can acknowledge a person's reality and feelings as true for them, whether or not you agree with it. So if I have a child who, let's say, wants to play with the toys and someone else took the ball and they're really upset about that, well, as an adult, I know, like, well, there's so many other toys you can play with, right? Like, you can pick the doll, you can pick the truck, like, you don't have to play with the ball. Also, these toys are for everyone to share, it's not just yours, right? So from the perspective of an adult, I might think, I don't know why you're upset, there's lots of other options. But for the child, right, they wanted that ball, so their perception of it is, I'm upset because what I wanted isn't available. Okay? So what I can do is I can let the child know, I understand that you're upset, right, and I understand how you're feeling, even if I don't agree with it. Okay? So validating a child's feelings and affirming a child's feelings are different. So again, this goes back to the idea of whether or not you agree with it. So when you affirm a child's feelings, that means you agree. Like, yes, you should be upset. You know, like, that person took your ball, that's not okay. When you're validating a child's feelings, that's saying what you're feeling right now is your reality, and this is true to what you are experiencing. So it's not helpful to say things like, who cares? It doesn't matter. Get over it, or just let it go. Because when you do that, what you're doing is you're dismissing the child's feelings. What you're saying is your feelings don't matter, right? We don't need to think about it. Don't worry about it, it's fine, right? But the thing is, it's not fine for the child. And so when you say things like, you know, who cares or it doesn't matter, what they hear is, my feelings don't matter. And when they hear my feelings don't matter, they think, I don't matter, because you don't care about my feelings. And so it's really important for, again, for the child to feel heard, for them to know that you understand them. So some things that you can say, right, these are about, like, validating statements you can say. So, like, that's really disappointing, or, like, that sounds really confusing. I'm sorry you're feeling sad about that. You know, you must have felt really ignored when she did that. So it's different things that you can sort of say to help reflect the emotion that they're feeling. Focus on listening, not lecturing. So, again, it's important for the child to feel heard. I think about, like, you know, if I was in a different country and I didn't speak the language, right, how frustrating it is when people don't understand you, right? So let's say I want to go to the train station. Someone, like, excuse me, do you know where the train station is? And someone's like, oh, the bathroom's over there. Well, no, I don't want the bathroom. I want the train station. Oh, the supermarket is 2 blocks down the street. No, I wasn't asking for the supermarket. I want the train station, right? And so think about how frustrating it is when you're trying to communicate to someone and they're not listening to you, right? They're just doing... They think they know best, right? Oh, yeah, it's over there. Oh, it's over on this side, right? And they mean well. They're trying to help. But if they're not listening to what I'm saying, it's not helpful to me, right? And then someone comes by and they're like, oh, the train station. I'm like, yes, that's what I want, the train station, right? So that feeling of relief of, yes, somebody gets me. Somebody understands what I'm trying to say. That's what we want to give to the child, right? So even if we can't fix the problem, even if we can't help them, even them knowing that we heard them and we understood it is a huge sense of relief for them. Proverbs 18:13 says, he who answers before listening, that is his folly and his shame. So again, we want to resist the urge to criticize or pass judgment. So if a child is telling us about their feelings, we don't want to judge their feelings. We don't want to tell them, you know, you shouldn't feel that way, or it's not okay to feel that way. We really want to listen to what they have to say. So again, as I mentioned earlier, some things that you can do is reflect the things that you hear them say to you. So even if a child, you know, is telling you how they feel and you don't know what to say, some of the easiest things you can do is just repeat back exactly what you heard. So it sounds like you're feeling sad because somebody took the ball you wanted. Okay? So again, you're giving words to their experience. And then in the future, if the same thing happens, rather than getting upset, they can say, I'm sad because somebody took my ball. So you're giving them the words to know how to express their feelings. And when you reflect things back to them, it shows them that you heard them and that you understood what they said. So now you know that you guys are on the same page. Okay. And then the last thing is, it's not always helpful to try and fix the problem. I know that for us, we have our own anxiety about there's something wrong, we need to fix it. Right? That's how we're trained, is when there's a problem, you solve it. A lot of times, I think children actually have the ability to fix their own problems or to solve their own problems. They just need help and support. So a lot of times, listening to them and sort of maybe asking them questions or guiding them can help them to develop their own problem-solving skills rather than trying to jump in and just fix it for them right away. Now, of course, that's not always the case. There are also going to be lots of things that we do need to do for kids. But I think it's important to think about, you know, is this something that maybe they could do on their own? Okay. So for confidentiality, confidentiality is a guarding and respecting of the gift of trust. So basically, when someone tells you something, right, we want to respect the fact that they trusted us enough to share this information with us. And we want to respect that by not sharing it with everybody else. When you maintain confidentiality, so when you don't share that information with other people, it lets the child know that you're safe to talk to. And then in the future, if they are feeling upset or maybe something even worse happens, they're more likely, again, to come back to you and want to share with you. And we want to maintain that level of trust with others. Now, again, I said there is an exception to that, so sometimes it might be necessary to share with other people, and that's when it comes to safety. So if a child talks about hurting themselves, so engaging in any kind of harming behaviors like cutting, burning, anything like that, we want to make sure that an adult knows about that. So if you're not the parent, letting the parents know about that. I think it's really tricky in how to do that, so I would definitely ask... If you know professionals, ask how to go about doing that. I think one of the biggest things, though, is bringing the child into it and making sure that they know what you're doing. Because they trusted you with the information, and so you don't want to go behind their back and almost like tattletale to their parents about it. So sometimes what you can do is let the child know, your safety is the most important thing to me, and so I do need to talk to your parents about this, but, you know, do you want to be part of that conversation? Do you want to do it with me together? So really bringing them into it so that way they also have some level of control. And then the last one is being open to help. So Ecclesiastes says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil, for if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. So if you do have a situation where there is a child or an adolescent who is struggling and you're not sure what to do, reach out for help. You know, ask a colleague, ask a friend. Don't try to take all of that on by yourself. Know when to reach out to others. You can ask others for advice. And then the last one is, again, seeking professional help. So if you feel like it's outside of what you're able to do, you know, it's okay to ask for professional help from either a school counselor or sometimes a therapist or the doctor. You can always ask these people. And then steps toward healing. So these are just some important things that help us kind of improving it better. So the feeling of being loved and understood is important. Right? We want to give that to children. Social and spiritual connections, so making sure that we have really good people around us who can support us and make us kind of keep us accountable. Coping skills and hobbies, so things that can sort of prevent us from falling into sort of this negative mindset. We want to take care of our physical health as well. That's going to affect our mood. Slowing down, that has to do a lot with like anxiety. If you're always on the go, always doing things, you want to make sure that you have time to really listen to what's going on with me right now. Seeking professional help, and then also thinking about your own health. So in order to take care of children and to take care of others, you also have to make sure that you're in a good place too. So wanting to watch out for yourself. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Right. actually identified it again. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 legitimately ritual possession misbehaviors that are being avoided. Are they like when you try to identify, do you have like a 4 out of 6 or 3 out of 5 or how many, especially for young children like toddlers or preschoolers?
Right.
Is the ritual, is there just issues at their age?
Right.
How do we identify their normal and healthy?
I think that for younger kids, we would expect more rituals just because they haven't learned about the world yet. So for them, they need to do something that makes sense.
And they're rigid too, right?
Yeah, and they do tend to be more rigid. I think where it comes up more is when you see the really big tantrums. I think that's when you start to notice, like if you try to do something a little bit different, they start to get really upset. They're crying, they're screaming, they're throwing things. I think that's a little bit more concerning. Yes. Yeah, I think with that too, it's also knowing when to, like how long it takes them to calm down. I don't know how much research there is about it, but I don't think we usually see a lot of anxiety in like 2-year-olds, just because, again, they do a lot of screaming, they do a lot of yelling and all of that.
So,
possibly, yes, but I think that would also be normal because, again, they don't know the world yet, and so we expect them to be anxious because everything is so new and strange to them. Yeah, that would be normal and anxious. Yeah. Yes.
I'm just curious that how much the emotion learned and how much the
That's a really good question. Yeah. I don't know about like a percentage in terms of how much is innate and learned. I know a lot of it is learned. So even if you think about babies, when something happens, like if they trip and fall, the first thing they do is they look at mom, right? Or they look at the person nearby to see what is your reaction. And if your reaction is like, oh my gosh, are you okay? And you start freaking out, they're going to start freaking out, right? Because they learned, oh, this is something scary, I should be worried. But if you're really more calm, like, oh, okay, like, you know, you're okay. Like, oh, that might hurt a little bit. They tend to be a little bit more calmer because they're looking to you to see how am I supposed to be reacting to this? So I think in that sense, a lot of it is learned. But I don't know about specific research for that. That's a really good question, though. Yeah. Any other questions?
We have a case. We know his family is borderline a lot, but he's always acting out in the class. But we really have hard time within the class. But why? I mean, this boy has a lot of attention. Now he has a brother or sister coming.
Yes. But recently.
And he has a sense of a sister.
Okay.
Yeah, but before that, things were already bad. But now it's getting worse.
Right.
So with this situation, we really have a hard time helping him. And because of his behavior, the whole class kind of isolated. So he always has to involve the fight. So he's fourth grade. It's not like fifth grade. For our children's church, we know the parents this is like four, like his mother and the father and the grandpa, grandma all live together.
Okay.
And maybe it's too much love. And then, yes, but we don't think when he was born, he had some problem with his mental.
Okay.
But recently, it's worse.
Okay.
We want to know how to handle this kid. He had taught in third grade.
Yeah.
The whole new service, he can't stay at the classroom. He can't.
Okay.
We need to help him to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Help us to, like, count the people among and to help. Give the kids the cookie to the kids. We need to let them to do something.
Right.
Yeah, but if I want to talk with him, something, are you okay? Are you have bullying at school? I will think about it. But
yeah.
He's
okay.
He can't help with
me. Okay.
So this is the true case.
Yeah, it sounds difficult.
Yes,
yeah. I don't know the family situation, so it's hard to say why he might be doing those things. I know with younger children, they need a lot of boundaries and a lot of structure. So, like if one person says, no, you can't do that, and then another person says, oh yeah, it's okay if you do that, they get really confused because they don't know, can I do that or can I not do that? So then it makes it really hard for them to know how to act in a lot of situations. So maybe in the home, you know, you say he's very loved, so maybe they let him do a lot of things at home that at school he's not allowed to do, and so he's doing a lot of these things. I don't know. I think it's a good idea to kind of get him to help out, make him feel more involved. If you have a lot of energy, getting him to use a lot of that energy. I think in terms of kind of talking with him, if he's not ready to talk, I don't think there's any way to get him to talk about it. Sometimes it's easier if you do an activity together, because just face-to-face feels very scary for people for talking. But if you do an activity, maybe ask questions while you're doing the activity together, he might be more open to talking, because that way it's not just, the focus isn't all just on him at one time. Does that make sense?
So one time our teachers saw everybody see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. But others have activities of learning something by them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, or you and your large group, the teachers say something.
Okay.
You can show me some emotion.
Okay.
But we think it's like he just wants to do what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be one where if parents are also seeing problems, like at home or at school, maybe that might be a good opportunity to kind of refer out for additional help, so maybe get him evaluated if there are lots of concerns. I don't know what it's like for him at school or at home either, but he might need some additional support. So, yeah, but it sounds like you guys are already trying to put in some structure for him, like letting him do things. So I would say keep doing that. I would say any type of positive reinforcement you can give when he does something he's supposed to do. So I really like that you're sitting so quietly. Thank you for doing that. Like, you were such a good helper today. So giving a lot of positive praise when he does something good. And then instead of saying, like, don't do that or stop doing that, tell him what he should be doing. So if he's standing up, instead of saying, you know, don't stand up, say, oh, make sure to stay seated. Okay, oh, make sure you're looking at the teacher or, you know, whatever it is. Because if you say, like, don't do that or stop doing that, he doesn't know what he's supposed to do. So giving him, like, a replacement behavior instead could maybe be something to try.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Do you have two students that they don't talk in the class,
mm-hmm.
Sunday school,
okay.
And they don't respond to you.
Okay.
Even don't respond to their assignment.
Okay.
Some game time, they don't participate in the game.
Okay.
So I feel a little bit, I don't know why, how to help him more.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has been in the church environment in the Sunday school for more than 2 years.
Okay.
Even this classic, they say,
mm-hmm.
Oh, he doesn't talk.
Okay.
He doesn't, like, speak up. Or,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know if that's good to help him, because last time I just tried to push him, like, walk together to the game, so he kept in the game.
Yeah.
He was really resistant. He was
resisting.
Angry.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
resisting.
Right.
But eventually he came to the group, like, I
okay.
Right thing to do, or just nothing. I think he does a lot of sitting aside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, see maybe if his parents have any ideas of things that he might be interested in. So if he likes cars or likes trucks or something, maybe you can use that to sort of make him feel more comfortable, to bring him to play with other kids. It's hard to say why he doesn't want to. It could be that he's scared, or maybe he doesn't know how to play with other kids. There might be lots of different reasons, but I think asking... Yeah. Yeah, 2 years. Okay. Yeah, I would ask parents and see what their thoughts are on that. If they have concerns about that, if that's something that they're seeing kind of everywhere he goes. You know, like, does he play at school with other kids? Does he play at home? And maybe there's a toy at home that he really likes to bring it with him to church, and he feels a bit more safe. It's something familiar. You can use that to sort of get him to do other things.
If it's happening everywhere, then probably something.
Yeah, probably, because that would be concerning if he's not engaging at all with anybody. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
any resource provider. If the school teacher, you find out in your classroom, you have all of the, having all the kids, you have all the control, right?
Mm.
So any resource, we can make a, I would say make a referral, because I'm like a make a referral, yeah. So do you have any resource?
I can put together like a, yeah, a research page of information and send it
okay.
to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
One more question. Yes.
Any other questions? No. Okay. My contact information is up here, so if at any point you guys have any specific questions or things that I didn't address, so you can go ahead and send me an email. If you could put ABC 2019 in the subject, that would be really helpful, just so that it doesn't get to my spam folder, so that way I know sort of where you're emailing me from. But yeah, if you need resources, referrals, or have any questions, feel free to email me.
That's good. So now that goes through me.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for all the information box. And the girl was posted from the ABC.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.